This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Alliance Bank presents you The Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss on BFM 89.9, the business station.
On The Breakfast Grill today is John C. Jack Bogle. He's the founder and retired CEO of the Vanguard Group. He pioneered the concept of the index fund in the 70s, which are passive investments that just merely track the market, resulting in lower costs and higher returns for investors. Vanguard has over the years accumulated trillions of dollars in managed assets and is one of the world's largest fund managers. So Jack, you started this whole indexing craze, and which over the years, this idea has put trillions of dollars of management money into Vanguard. Now, indexing, of course, represents the passive school of investing where you allow the market to do the work for you. And this is a concept that's still unfamiliar in Malaysia, but isn't indexing a little lazy? Shouldn't one put some work into picking the right stocks and put money with managers that do so?
Well, of course that's right, but just visualize what indexing is for a minute. And let me use the United States stock market as an example. There's a stock market out there, and it's got 3,000 stocks in it, and they all have a certain market value. And that market value all adds up to, you know, in the range of 18 to 20 trillion dollars. So all the stockholders together have that $20 trillion. Here in the United States, about a third of all mutual fund investors choose to own that portfolio, if you will, of 3,000 stocks. I'm oversimplifying just a bit here, by owning what we call an index fund. If the stock market goes up, the index fund goes up exactly the same amount. And if the stock market goes down, the index fund goes down the same amount. So about one-third of all those assets, call it maybe $6 trillion, is indexed, and about $12 trillion is run by active managers, pension fund managers, individual investors, investment advisors, and everybody else who's not in the index fund. So those two portfolios are the same. They have the same stocks in them. The index portfolio has about one share of stock for every two in the active portfolio. So their performance will be identical. So the magic of indexing is you can own that portfolio, that stock portfolio, for a cost of about what we call 5 basis points, 0.05%. In other words, you capture almost the entire market return. On the other hand, these managers have costs. Their brokers, their investment advisors, their marketing and advertising costs, their administration costs, all those kind of things. And it's very tax inefficient, too, with all that trading. And all those managers will get that same return as the index investors, minus 2%. So over per year, so over an investment lifetime, the indexer gets about $3 of return for every dollar of return, believe that or not. But it's the magic of compounding, for every dollar of return by the people that are participating actively. So it's growing because it's mathematically true. It's just the ultimate diversification and the ultimate the lowest cost way to invest there is. And if you understand the market, as I've tried to explain it, we all share the market return together, all of us investors. The question is how much we want to pay for it. And that makes a huge difference. So it's shooting the lights out over here. Has been for, I guess, but started to do very well. I started the world's first index fund back in 1975. And our index funds are now the largest in the world. We're the largest manager, $3 trillion in the world. It took years to catch on. By the mid-1990s, it started to catch on. It's been growing ever since. And now accounts for, well, money is pouring into index funds here in the U.S., pouring out of active funds.
Now, Jack, an impression that mutual funds come in all shapes and sizes now, and words like tactical and quantitative strategies and sectoral funds seem very impressive. Surely these managers must know what they're doing.
Well, they all know what they're doing. Virtually all of them know what they're doing. But in markets being markets, some of them are going to be right and some of them are going to be wrong. And if one manager over on that active side is above average, there is another manager that must be a below average. And if one manager beats the market by, say, 5 percentage points a year, a huge amount over time, then there's another manager that must lose by 5% a year. It's all in the math.
Has the research... I was just about to ask, has the research been quite conclusive in this area that index funds on average beat actively managed funds?
The research is overwhelmingly positive, endorsed by every Nobel Prize winner in economics in the United States and for all I know in the world. It's the way finance is taught in our universities over here and business schools. It's tested and tried, and people would like to drive holes in the system, but no one has yet, and they've had pretty much 40 years to do so.
Do you subscribe to more nuanced passive strategy, like buying into baskets of cheap stocks or small companies?
Well, I do not subscribe to those strategies because they involve change. Small companies do well for a while, and then they did badly. They did badly last year. So-called value companies and low price earnings multiples have over time done better, but they also fell on their faces last year. So if you're going to do it, you have to figure out when to get in and when to get out. And I don't think that is doable. Market timing, it's kind of a thing. You know, you could say it's over for the small cap stocks and now go to large cap stocks. Well, those decisions are not easy to make. And the one thing I've talked about a lot over here in the U.S., Julian, is what we call reversion to the mean. And that is what deceives us badly about investment management here in the U.S. and I think all over the world. Is if we decide we want an active manager, how do we go about it? We look backward. Which manager has done the best? Well, managers that are good turn bad ultimately, and managers that are bad turn good ultimately. So it's what we call reversion to the mean. Things come back to the average, and you're simply paying too much to let that happen to you.
Now, of course, when you talk about costs, many Vanguard funds, as you pointed out, don't have sales fees and management fees are minute. The Malaysian scenario is quite different. 3 to 5% sales commissions, 1.5% to 2% in annual management fees. Are Malaysians being duped?
Well, a non-Malaysian is not going to tell anybody in Malaysia that he's being duped. But I can say categorically, they are paying far too much for the service they can possibly get. It's basically, if those charges were on an index fund, it would be a breach of fiduciary duty by the fund. When other index funds are available for a fraction of that amount, they don't cost very much to run because they buy and hold forever. And they have low transaction, virtually no transaction costs. As you say, no sales flows and tiny costs. So it's more a question of opening investors' eyes to the reality of investing. Not a speculative game, it's a long-term investment game.
Now, you've also set up Vanguard in a structure where Vanguard is owned by the funds, which in turn are owned by the shareholders, and you argue that this avoids third-party management costs, but don't the managers have to earn something?
Well, the managers get paid, and it's part of our expense. I mean, we're not working for nothing. I mean, I work for virtually nothing now, but when I was running the company, I was well-paid, but the funds just share the expenses of Vanguard. And spread over these large asset base, now the costs are very low. We run this whole firm for around what we call 15 basis points, or 0.15 of 1%, and the industry averages about 1.15% on that expense ratio basis alone. That saves you a percentage point a year. Well, over the long run, that's priceless. And what's more, we have no sales loads. That's a big saving. We have no significant portfolio transaction costs. Because we don't turn over the portfolio, we buy and hold. Where over here in the U.S., other managers are turning over their portfolios at very large numbers, maybe up to 100% a year. So it just, of course we have costs, but we do our best to take that profit element that goes to the management companies, other management companies, and give it back to the shareholders.
John Bogle, the founder and retired CEO of the Vanguard Group, is on The Breakfast Grill today. Up next, his views on what to invest in. On The Breakfast Grill this morning is John Bogle, the founder and retired CEO of the Vanguard Group. Vanguard is one of the biggest fund managers in the world. Now, you often advocate buying into a broad U.S. index rather than a global index for Americans because U.S. companies have significant foreign earnings and are pretty well diversified. But what about emerging market residents like ourselves? Should we consider a global index fund or an American index fund?
Well, I think we can agree that the American business and the American economy is the most diversified on the face of the earth, the strongest on the face of the earth, the most innovative and technologically advanced on the face of the earth. And in the U.S., we have institutions, regulators, laws, and traditions that assure the rights of stockholders. That's very important. You can't put a number on it, but it's very important. And those rights here are as good as they are anywhere in the world. Maybe Great Britain would be a little bit better or not. I don't know, or the United Kingdom. But they'd be right up there, too. And Switzerland would be right up there. But a lot of times you're putting your money at risk because institutions can go down. And I'm not talking about any particular institution in any particular country, but the idea of concentrating on the biggest country in the world, we're about 45%, I guess, of the world's market capitalization, the U.S. alone. It would seem to be a minimum position to have half of your money. This is for someone in Malaysia, have half of the money in the U.S. And then what do you do with the rest? Well, you know, I'm not an expert in the Malaysian economy right there. That's probably a place that you would want to have some significant investment, and it could easily be indexed, and should be. And then if you want to go out there in the world, outside of the U.S., outside of your home country, well, any investor is free to do that. And I worry a little bit, and I'm an American, that I don't see the need to go outside of the U.S. It's possible that some of these countries outside of our own will grow faster than the U.S., Now, certainly the economies of the emerging markets have grown faster, although, interestingly enough, the stock markets of the emerging market haven't done any better than the U.S. If you go back to the, I guess, mid-80s when emerging markets started to be available here, the U.S. market has actually done better. That's not proof of anything. It all depends on what happens tomorrow. I know that. But when I look at the large companies in the non-U.S. market, countries, I should say, in the non-U.S. market. I look at Great Britain, they seem to be struggling. I look at Japan, they are definitely struggling. I look at France, well, I don't know what to say about France. They don't have a particularly good work ethic. they seem to be leaning very leftward. And those are the three largest companies you own.
Right, Jack, if I may play the devil's advocate a little, the emerging markets actually represent the region where incomes are rising and the middle classes are expanding rapidly. Can we say that the emerging markets will outperform the U.S. over the long term?
Well, I cannot say that. First, there's not a necessary tie-in between how an economy performs and how the stocks of the company in that economy perform. There are big variations. Second, we see in the charts and the trends, there are periods when the emerging markets do much better than the U.S., and we see there are periods when, as it is in the last 5 or 6 years, where they do worse than the U.S. They were barely even last year, I think, and the U.S. was up 14%. That's an odd year, but all years are odd years. And also, I look at the market, Julian, as what I will call a great arbitrageur between the past and the future. Mm-hmm. And let me say that emerging markets are expected, the stocks in emerging markets are expected to grow faster than stocks in the U.S. market. But prices usually reflect that. You're not the only one that knows that emerging market earnings have the potential to grow bigger. It's in the marketplace. So the market is usually fairly priced. So if, for the purpose of argument, if I grant your devil's advocate position, I could say, well, maybe the emerging markets will do as much as, this would be a large number, 2 percentage points a year better than the U.S. You said the U.S. did 7% a year and the emerging markets did 9. Well, if you were all in emerging markets, that would make a big difference. But if you're 50-50, the difference would only be 1 percentage point in your total return. And I wouldn't recommend heavy concentrated bets. So, and even using the word betting, I find kind of offensive, even though I'm using it here. Because the stock market is a casino. And once you make your bets, my opinion, you should get out of the casino and just let the profits roll over time as they will.
This may sound like repeating the question, but what do you think of China? Because China, in a few years' time, will replace America as the biggest economy in the world. Would they go through the same kind of characteristics, the diversification characteristics and so on that you find in the United States currently?
Well, China is, first of all, I think, to almost everybody, a rather great mystery. There's obviously this huge swing from an agricultural economy toward an urban economy. It's hard to know what the outcome of all that is. It's hard to know how a society can change that much that quickly. I think investing in China is quite risky. As we've just seen, investing in Russia is quite risky. Even large countries have their own individual characteristics. So when you say investing in China, should it be a part of your investment program? I would hardly object if it were a small part. Should it be all of your investment program? I think that would be, given the uncertainties, the transitions, the most foolish thing you could possibly do. It may pay off big. So I would never tell anybody, no, never do this or that, but I would say stick to principles like diversification, stick to a principle like investing, holding your stocks for the long term, and not trying to trade them and beat the markets at various times, because it can't be done for investors as a group. So I am the apostle of simplicity, the apostle of thrift, and the apostle of low cost for investors, so they get their fair share of market returns.
Right, certainly a very good virtues to have. But the question I want to ask about America is that, is the U.S. in bubble territory given the years of phenomenal returns? I mean, P valuations seem pretty high. Do you see a reversion back to average returns or even negative returns going forward?
I see a reversion to lower returns, and I see it for one big reason, and that is our long-term returns here in nominal terms, current dollar terms, have been about 9% over history. And that is 4.5% from dividend income, as it happens, and 4.5% from earnings growth. The companies grow along with the economy. In short periods, speculative return, how much people will pay for those, how many times earnings people will pay for those stocks, goes up and down, but in the end it means nothing. So we are probably a little bit high in the PE side. I'm using a number, price earnings multiple side. I think stocks are selling around 20 times earnings here. I'm pretty hard on those data. And so the market is not in cheap territory, but bubble territory that we had back in the late 90s and early 2000s. The stock market was selling at 35 or 40 times earnings, twice what it is today. So it's clearly, I think it is not a bubble, but it is not a license to steal at these levels either. So with today's dividend yield being not 4.5%, the long-term norm, but 2% happens to be where we are today, you should look at stocks to yield to provide a return of about 2 percentage points lower than the past, and that is, say, something like 7%, 6 or 7% rather than 9. So I think that is, as we say over here, the new normal. I wish it were higher, but the market is the market. And you have to say to yourself, well, you know, it sounds a lot, I would say it sounds, if not high, certainly not cheap. But if you decide you don't want to be in the stock market, where do you want to be?
And talking about that, what do conservative investors do with bonds right now? Because yields are at record lows, which is bad for income. And the next move for interest rates is probably up, which is bad for bond prices. So should conservative investors engage in some kind of active strategy?
I would say no, because we just don't know. I believe bonds merit a place in an investment program, particularly for the average U.S. investor and the average world investor who has a reasonable amount of wealth, at least, because it is a very wealthy nation, and this is not a very wealthy world that we live in. So you have to make that distinction. But I think you need a bond position just to give your portfolio some stability. It's a sacrifice, almost certainly going to be a sacrifice in long-term return. On the other hand, it will reduce your tendency, our tendency, the investor's tendency, what I will call bad behavior. And that is you think you can guess the market, what it's going to do. And so you say, I'm not going to own any bonds. And then the stock market goes down 50%, which it could do at any time, of course. I've seen three of them in my lifetime. And at the bottom of the market, you panic. You say, I've lost half my money. I'm out of here.
But Jack, you know, for some of these investors, bonds are the only thing they can afford to invest in because they want that security and they can't put money into stocks over the long term because they need their money in the short term. What do they do right now?
Well, I would say for an investor like that, short-term bonds with maybe a little seasoning of intermediate-term bonds would be the appropriate portfolio. You know, the volatility goes up as the maturity level goes up. And I don't have these data exactly in my mind, but the volatility of what we call duration here of a short-term portfolio is probably 1, of an intermediate-term portfolio, 8, and a long-term portfolio probably pretty close to 20. And those numbers, 1, 8, and 20, are the percentage point change that will happen to a bond, the change in price, if if interest rates go up or down by 1 percentage point. So if interest rates go up by 2 percentage points, the short-term bond would go down 2%, the intermediate-term bond would go down for 16%, and the long-term bond would go down by 36%. So I avoid the long-term market because of the risk, and for investors thinking about savings, I would stay strictly short-term, and you'll get a yield here in the U.S. of around 2% is all.
And you spoke a little bit earlier about bad behavior in investing. And as a result of this, you frown upon exchange-traded funds or ETFs, which have seen trillions of dollars poured into them. And these are like index funds, but listed in the stock market. Do you think that if someone held an ETF, like how they held an index fund, that is to buy and hold them forever, is that a good solution for such people?
Well, of course it is. I mean, I have often said exchange-traded funds are fine just so long as you don't trade them. But for us at Vanguard, we have exchange-traded funds for, let's say, our Standard & Poor's 500 index fund. It's part of the same portfolio. We have a single portfolio. There's a regular class of shares, what I call traditional index fund, and the ETF class, they're the same portfolio. They get the same return. They have the same cost, that is to say, about 0.05% a year, so it's indifferent. But for someone, the mutual funds, the traditional funds, Julian, are not exactly locked up forever. You can redeem them every afternoon at 4 o'clock. And what additional value is added by letting you trade them during the day is not clear to me. I think there is no value to it because investors are apt to panic during the day, and then the market comes back in the afternoon after they've gotten out. You know, it's not as if you can liquidate your mutual fund holding at current value on any business day. And if that's not good enough for you, I'm wondering what your thought process is.
Yes, that's a good point. Now, you wrote a very interesting book, which is entitled Enough. And if I'm not wrong, this is about how one can just have just enough of wealth to make them happy. So does this not go against the motive of the so-called rational investor to maximize profits?
Well, I'm not against the rational investor maximizing profits. I'm saying for most people in this world, you're going to have to be satisfied with less than being a billionaire, even here in the U.S. So what are we striving for here? We're striving for a comfortable retirement. We're striving for enough wealth to educate, send our children to college. We're striving enough so we can have a little bit nicer house and a little nicer neighborhood and maybe a little nicer car. You know, being in a warm, dry place with a roof over your head, surrounded by your family, is not, Julian, a fate worse than death. So I think it's a matter of contentment. And what this great striving for super wealth is, I think, has taken on a very unattractive kind of a look because you start to get cheating. You start to get inside trading. You start to get fraud, as we saw in the Bernard Madoff case here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the case of some of our big corporations, WorldCom, Enron, Tyco, were all basically looted because the people that were running them were greedy, too greedy. So I happen to be the kind of person, I don't know how many are more like me than this other group, but my idea is to do the best you can, but be a little bit satisfied with what you've got. Don't be jealous. Don't try and keep up with the Joneses. And then, you know, my wife and I live a very nice life. Neither of us likes to spend money. What is all that spending about? Well, I guess you could observe, Julian, that if everybody in the economy like me refused to walk into a mall and hadn't bought himself anything new in 10 years, the American economy would collapse. And I suppose there's some truth to that. But it's really philosophical reflections, I think I'd say, about what life is about. And it's surely, I'm sure you'd agree with me, about more than the collection of the largest number of toys before you die. Toys in the metaphorical sense.
Jack, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for your time. And that was John C. Jack Bogle, the founder and retired CEO of the Vanguard Group. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9.
The BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by Alliance Bank. Banking made personal. A total banking relationship that rewards you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.